I'm Christopher Lydon with Sean Connery playing the part of a political economist. His real name is Mark Blythe, professor at Brown University and at our host, the Watson Institute. He's a one-man demonstration of how far you can go in economics just by talking straight, sort of pub talk, with a strong Scots accent. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Mark Blythe, last time we were talking about Ireland and the threat to deflate the whole Eurozone. This time, our last conversation of 2010, talk about the whole year.
It's lovely to be back, he said in his best Sean Connery. From now on, whenever he refers to me in the Scottish brogue nonsense, I think what I'll do is basically refer to him as Miss Moneypenny from this point on. Anyway, nice to be back, Chris. 2010, how bad was it? Well, you know, we're still alive. Well, it depends on who we is, I suppose. It could have been a lot worse. And continually what we see is this pattern, which I've seen in American politics for a very long time, whereby the Democrats have two sort of pathologies going on. The first one is what was once said about the Palestinians. They never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. So there's been plenty of that going on. But the other one is the historical mission, if you will, of the Democrats since basically around 1970 seems to be to come in and clean up the mess the Republicans make and then get absolutely no credit for it. In fact, get discredited for it because, of course, things aren't getting any better, so on and so forth. Look, they're spending all this money and nothing's happening. And then they get flung out in their ears. And once that happens, of course, they've usually cleaned up the mess. The Republicans come in, they go party time again, create all sorts of fiscal dysfunctions and crises, and then they create a huge mess, and then the Democrats come in and pick it up. We found out after the election that the official ambition of the Republicans is to make sure that Obama is a one-term president. And it looks like they're probably going to get their wish. So there's your first thing for 2012.
You were sounding like Barack Obama, that things are not so bad or that we're making incremental progress back. Why doesn't it win?
Because unemployment is still on the official measure, just hovering around 10%. If you look at what's called the U6 measure, which is people who were on payroll, were then on benefit and neither show up now on payroll nor benefit, broadly speaking, it's about 18.3%. So one in five Americans don't have a job. It's really hard to be a popular politician when one in five Americans are disappearing from payroll. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is what energizes the right in the Tea Party movement in particular. And I think I said this when the last time I was on the program. They've got a point. The point is that the taxpayer was used to bail out the banks. And the banks are back, and they're giving out bonuses again, and they're carrying on as if nothing's happened, and the put has been on the taxpayer. And now they're going to have to pay again, as I said before, not just once through the bailout costs, but also through the austerity programs that are going to come down the line once the Republicans get control of Congress. Although we'll see how this one works out, I have my doubts that whereas countries like Britain that have unitary executives and very hierarchical parliamentary institutions can come in and say, this is the budget, you're taking the hit, end of story. When it really gets down to it, are the Republicans going to put the mortgage interest tax deduction on the block? Are they really going to shut down some of the military's pet programs? Are they really going to put Social Security on the table? I have my doubts that that's really going to happen.
That's my question. Who's going to beat the sort of inch-by-inch Obama simulated progress? And what's the economic platform going to be?
Well, the economic platform for beating them could be anything in the sense that, well, look, we've had 4 years. Look what's happened to the debt. It's gone up. Look what's happened to the deficit. It's skyrocketed. Once again, you have these tax and spend liberals in power, and nothing's got better. In fact, more Americans are unemployed now than they were under George Bush. Vote Republican. It writes itself. You don't get any credit for basically putting an emergency floor on the building as the top floor is impacting into the basement. And that's what the Democrats have done over the past 2 years and will continue to do. They're still putting the floor on the building as the roof's caving in.
What's happening in the wider world, Mark Blythe? I mean, you could draw a picture for people like me of China and India, the growth states, 8%, the United States and Europe, the 2% growth, rich countries. Europe really stalled. The United States still in fundamental difficulty. What's to make of the overall pattern?
Well, you can read a little bit too much into growth rates. You've got to look at the relative baselines that you're growing from. Would you rather grow from $50,000 per capita on average, a skewed average, I admit, but let's just take that as the number, and you grow at 2%, or would you rather have $6,000 and grow at 10%? There's a huge difference in those things. And when people got all wigged out about China and India, they completely forget that when you're talking about China, a really good way to think about China is the following. China is two Germanys, right? So you basically have 1.2 billion people, 1.3 billion people. And they've taken 400 million out of poverty. That means that they've managed to get them to a per capita baseline of about $5,600. The coastal cities, which are very, very large, you add them together and the other growth nodes in the economy, you're talking about 200 million people that have Western consumption patterns. So in terms of overall consumption, you're talking about the effects of two Germanys in the global economy. Two Germanys is big. Two Germanys is important. Two Germanys isn't, oh my God, the sky is falling. So I think we need to be a little bit, you know, more circumspect about this. India, yeah, fabulous. It's a high-tech services hub. It's great. It's growing at all this wonderful pace. It's not doing much in terms of industry. Manufacturing seems to be the Chinese game. They're doing a little bit more in that. But essentially, when you're doing services, particularly for the rest of the world, you're dependent upon demand generated elsewhere in the world. And let's not forget, here's the thing that people forget about India. While it is certainly true that Bangalore's booming, at the last count, I believe there were 7 Maoist insurgencies going on in the countryside. Mm. And you still have 600 million peasants who are dirt poor, who are simply not part of this boom and this whole globalization game. So if I had to, if I were a sovereign bond buyer, and I had to think about where I was stashing my money, I would think 2010 was a nightmare. Because I can't really buy Chinese assets yet. And if I do, I don't know what I'm getting. I can't really buy Indian assets. Well, I can, but do I know what I'm getting? And as I'm making a one-way bet, we've seen emergent markets go bust before. What happens if the Maoists actually take over somewhere important? I got to factor all that in. I look at the Eurozone, and that's a good laugh, because basically you've managed to get all these countries that are really successful and really rich and relatively unskewed income distributions that have tied themselves to a fiscal time bomb because of the Eurozone bond crisis.
Right.
And then you've got the United States. And it is printing too much money in a quantitative sense, and its growth rate is too low, but it's got good demographics, and it's not likely to turn into a dictatorship anytime soon. But really, would I want to buy those bonds if I had any alternative? Probably I'd like to buy something else, but what's my alternative? Am I going to buy Euro bonds? Am I buying Chinese bonds? Am I buying Indian bonds? Can we all join in the march to Brazil? What would happen if we do? You just crack their exchange rate up so much that they end up falling off a cliff. So there are limits to where all this can go. Don't forget that we are the reserve currency. It's really difficult for everybody else to get out of the reserve currency all at once. Mm. So there's lots of structural factors that keep the United States much more secure than people think. Yeah, China's expanding, China's growing. Basically, you got two Germanys that are shaking off 200 years of torpor, mistreatment, and colonialism, and good luck to them. So far, they've been really great global citizens, by and large. They haven't invaded anyone. We have. They haven't. Let's remember that. So, you know, let's be a little bit more circumspect about what the problems and possibilities are of these two or more countries.
Go back to the Eurozone for a moment. Last time we talked, Ireland seemed to be deflating the whole balloon, and you were as worrisome and worried about it as anybody I know. They still haven't solved that problem, but they also seem to have settled into a world where a private banking crisis will masquerade from now on as a public debt crisis. Any way out on your scope yet?
No. I mean, I think I said this last time. There are four ways, or something like it, but I'll say it again because it's good. There are four ways out of any financial crisis. You inflate, you deflate, you devalue, you default. That's it. There's no other solutions. Hmm. So what have we decided to do? Well, if you're in the Eurozone, you cannot devalue because you don't control the currency. You don't want to inflate because, as we know, if they have the slightest bit of inflation, you end up like Germany in the 1920s, which is complete nonsense. But nonetheless, the fear of inflation is real. And it eats away at the holders of paper assets, those bondholders you're trying to protect. So what are you left with? Well, if you can't inflate and you can't deflate, you can either devalue. Oh, no, you can't really do devalue because you don't control the currency. So what do you have to do? You got to take it out in domestic wages and prices. Now, here's the problem. At the end of the day, Ireland and Spain and Greece and Italy and all those countries that are basically in the sights are all democracies. And this matters because even if you elect your government for a 5-year term, you can have, as Silvio Berlusconi just found out, a vote of no confidence. You can basically screw the pooch enough that people say, enough, we've had enough of these guys, let's throw the rascals out. And then you vote for somebody who says, we're not going to do this, we're not going to deflate anymore. Now, if I'm a sovereign bondholder, I know that it is inevitable that these governments are going to crack, that Cameron's coalition, high degree of probability over the next couple of years it falls apart. that there's a general election called, that the Irish government just basically say, we're going to kick this down the road for the next government, we're out of here, and the next government comes in and says, we need to renegotiate all the terms. So you've got these sovereign bondholders that know they're going to have to take, in the parlance of finance, a haircut. They're going to have to lose some of their principal investment. If that is the case, then what are they going to do? They're going to want to be as close as possible to being able to liquidate their assets before they fall in value. If everybody's standing by the door in a crowded theatre waiting for someone to say, fire, Chris, what do you think's going to happen? And that's where the Eurozone finds itself. Now, today, European Commission, or whichever part of the interminable workings of the EU, said that they were going to get past this contingent bailout mechanism and have some kind of new long-term, proper, grown-up fiscal settlement or set of institutions for resolving future bailouts. Well, there's two interesting things there. Number one, you're admitting there will be future bailouts. Number two, you're going to have to ram this through in an anti-democratic procedural manner, which means it'll have no legitimacy. And given the way that you've been behaving recently, it's highly likely the Irish are not going to vote for it, nor is anyone else. Or you open up the treaties again and start let's have another big renegotiation of Europe and what it's all about. After the Germans have been basically slapping everyone around and calling them profligates for the past 2 years. So Europe's got itself into a hell of a mess. And there's no easy way out of it. And the bottom line is, what happened was the German and French banks were holding a lot of Eurobond debt and German and French bonds. And then they looked at these peripheral debts, Greece, Italy, Spain, etc., and said, hey, these things are like, you know, a couple of basis points more risky. But, you know, if we buy billions of them and you do enough volume on the trade, we can swap all our sort of low-yield northern bonds for, like, higher-yielding southern bonds. Great, it's free money. Yeah, until it becomes apparent that everybody's been lying about stuff in the Eurozone, not paying attention to rules, all the rest of it. Suddenly you find out that those bonds are not worth what you thought they were. And then the bondholders and the sovereign bondholders outside those banks come along and say, whoops, we need to have more interest payments on this. And suddenly these banks are holding all these assets, which are not worth the paper they're written on. That's the fundamental problem. So you understand what's going on in Ireland. The Germans are holding a gun to the Irish head saying, here, take this money. You need to take it right now so you can pay it back to the German banks to help them clean their balance sheet. This is screwed up. I'd rather be in America in a heartbeat.
Thank God we are. Mark Blyth, I count on you to sort of stand back and keep a big score of the global crisis. We read the stock market, the unemployment rates day to day, but we know in our bones this is something much bigger than that. I keep thinking of a conference in this room 2 years ago, early days of Obama, and there were three conclusions I drew from a lot of smart people yammering. One, unless the West comes up with a better idea and a new act, China wins the crisis because it's got cash, it's got a production machine, it's got a state sort of co-designed by Milton Friedman and Stalin, and a lot of customers if they ever decide they want to move the goods at home. Second, all this turmoil really has the dimensions of a civilizational crisis. It's about who we really are. It's also about our relationship to the habitat and survival. Third, one way to look at Barack Obama, as an Italian Gramscian lawyer argued at that conference, is as the West's Gorbachev. The empire is rocking and shaking and maybe crumbling. Go in there, smart, nice guy, and save it. On those kinds of scales, I mean, how are we doing? Where are we 3 years into this monster?
Let's take them in reverse order. I'm glad I wasn't at the conference because I would have disagreed with everything that was said.
Well, everybody disagreed with everybody, so you would have been right at home.
That's true. Actually, I probably would have been good then. Let's start with the whole sort of the empire is going down.
It was at risk.
Or at risk. I mean, it depends on what you mean by empire, right? I mean, this is the funny thing about the American empire. As an immigrant to the United States, along with, you know, hundreds of millions who have done it over the past 100 years, it is this funny empire that people keep wanting to join. It's a really weird thing. The Italians are the best at this. They've got six U.S. military bases on their soil that fly unimpeded missions to Afghanistan and God knows where else, doing whatever the Americans want to do. And then they come over here, probably flying business class to get here, and then moan about the American empire. And it's a strange creature, this one.
See, well, they come here to get away from the American foreign policy.
When the British had an empire, you knew where you stood. You had no rights, you had only responsibilities. We owned the stuff and you got shat on. When the French had an empire, it was even clearer. This is a very odd empire where you get preferential trading agreements, better access to markets, technology transfers, and then all the sort of benefits that go along with hanging around in the dollar club. Oh, and then we'll also do this thing called NATO, where basically we'll bankroll your militaries for 35 years, and we'll keep it going 20 years after the Cold War, because it's just a good idea. This is the oddest empire I've ever seen. If you had to design an empire from scratch, and you could do whatever you want, this would not be it. This is a seriously funny empire. So I'll just push back on that one a little bit. Did they go into... Let me give you one example of this. So let's go into Iraq for oil, right? Okay, so let's assume that the United States foreign policy elite are not completely stupid. Now, there was certainly a huge amount of groupthink with Wolfowitz and the rest of these guys going on. But if you'd went out in 2002 and went on the spot market and basically bought oil future contracts at about $36 a barrel, you could have bought the entire Iraqi oil stock for one quarter of what we spent in Iraq. This is the stupidest empire the world's ever seen. So if it really was an empire, it should have fallen years ago. The problem is usual with empires, there's a hell of a lot of collaboration goes on. And all those collaborators on the periphery really don't want to be identified as such. They'd rather be throwing their copies of Gramsci at the wall. So let me take the second point on, which was about civilizational crisis.
Yeah.
Absolutely, right? Here's the deal. The environment is really, really, really important. And we are completely unable to agree even what the problem is. So I believe the last figure I saw was it's down now from over 50% to about 37% of Americans believe that global warming's a significant problem. Well, it is. And if you live in a democracy and only one in three agree it's a problem, nothing will get done. So we will temporize, we'll kick it down the road, we'll hope something else happens. And this is where the authoritarian states like China, who are industrializing at a pace, really do have an advantage. Because in a command and control economy, you don't have to negotiate with your steel mills about cap and trade or their trade association or the senators that are in their back pocket. You just say, you're cleaning up the technology, this is how it happens, end of story. So paradoxically, it may be that the authoritarians save us from climate change more than the democracies because they can't get their act together to do anything about it. So I think that that's absolutely true. The second side of this is more dubious. Who are we? What are we doing as we go forward? Blah, blah, blah. There's a tremendous sort of cultural arrogance about this, that there is this thing called the West, there is this thing called America. It stands for a whole unique set of values. And then there's China on the other side, who are these Oriental others, or India, or what happens to be. And we personalize this and turn it into stories, narratives about the rise of the East as if it's some kind of personification. When I look at the United States from the point of view of many of my European friends and colleagues, I see two things. I see 300 million fat, ill-educated, borderline dipsomaniac, diabetic and diabolical, lying on the couch, watching Fox News and consuming the planet to death. And then at the same time, what they also see is the most Machiavellian foreign policy elite the world's ever seen, that has its finger in every pie, that controls every government, that seamlessly executes every single outcome there, no matter what.
This is before or after WikiLeaks?
Anytime. We can talk about that in a minute. But these two ridiculous stereotypes of what the United States are simultaneously coexist as the frame as to what America is. Well, what is America? Well, America thinks it's something completely different from that. So I think all of these talks about sort of like the grand pictures of civilizations and values and all that sort of stuff, just a bunch of hooey. Let's deal with the fact that we've got a common planet, common problems, and move ahead on that basis. What was the last one?
First point was China's winning.
The Germans say this, well, yin, yes and no. China's winning what? As I said before, you've got two Germanys. They've got the most skewed income distribution practically on the planet. People forget this. When you forget the whole Maoist thing. If you're sick in China now and you don't show up at the hospital with a bag of money, you get left outside. It makes American healthcare look humane. You have an incredible number of people who are earning practically nothing. So the idea that they are going to be this consumption basket, that they're going to turn off the taps of the Western exports through exports and become this consumption monster, they'd love to do this. But the income distribution is so skewed, and it's so skewed by province and through different areas, that it's going to be very, very difficult to do this in the short term. So we have a phenomena going forward on the global level, which I like to call monetarily assured destruction. It's like the old, it's like the old MAD, right? Only this is the new MAD. Basically, they have all the money that they earn from us by selling stuff to Walmart. And they have all these Walmart dollars, and they're sitting on these dollars, and they can't buy the things they want, like Apple and Big Pharma. So then we gave them all this really good stuff, like treasury debt and agency debt, like buy some Fannie and Freddie stock, that's a good one. So then they're sitting on this stuff, and then we turn on the taps of quantitative easing, which is basically devaluation through the back door. So they're watching the value of their assets go down and down. What are they going to do? Buy more of their own government's debt? Buy some Indian debt? Buy some Brazilian debt? Or we're all going to buy, what, Saudi bonds? So they're sitting there going, we hate what you're doing, but there's nothing we can do about it. If we dump your currency, we destroy your economy, which is where we send all our bloody exports. If we do the same to Europe, the same thing happens. And we can't shift just from the United States to Europe or from Europe to the United States. So everybody's holding each other by the proverbial short and curlies, monetarily speaking, in this new version of monetarily assured destruction.
Mm. What if they decided finally to sell to their own people?
They can't. They don't have enough wealth distributed equally enough to make mass consumption possible. That's why it's going into a huge real estate bubble at the moment. It's skewed amongst the coastal cities.
Mm. Could they cure that problem if they really wanted to?
Yeah, they really could. But you'd have to basically take an income distribution that makes the United States look like Sweden and turn it into Sweden. Good luck with that.
Mark, what are the ideas underlying 2011? What are the big ideas or little ideas that are underlying the economic path in 2011?
I wish there were some big ideas. The basic story is this. Here's the most macro story I can think of. Back in the late 70s, the magic went away. We don't know why. To this day, we really don't. There were oil shocks. There was conflict. There was capital-labor conflict across the developed world. And we went from growth rates of 4% down to 2%, and inflation became a problem. And at that point, a bunch of people who'd been hanging around for a long time saying that all of this redistributionary demand-side Keynesianism will end badly suddenly got a hearing. And they took over big universities' econ departments, and they took over international organizations like the IMF, and they infiltrated the Treasury and other places. And the whole new version of the way the world works, the sort of the new classical and neoclassical view, which became the Washington Consensus for the developed world, which became independent central banks and inflation targeting for us, which became supply-side taxes, all that sort of stuff came to pass. As a consequence of this, lots of things were deregulated, including financial markets. And if you deregulate and integrate globally financial markets, you end up with what NPR guys once called a giant pool of money. It's a great way of thinking about it. And when you have a giant pool of money, interest rates get really low. And when they get really low, people borrow and spend and lever up and do all these sorts of things. And the rate of return in finance becomes twice that of the real economy. So you start living through different asset bubbles, a giant one in equities that goes from 87 to 97 to basically the dot-com bust. And then you got one in real estate, starts in 97 and goes to 2007. So we ride these two giant bubbles and we profit take and create highly skewed income distributions. And at the end of the day, that's what blew up. And it's not clear you can bring that model back because we cycle through equities, we cycle through real estate. Commodity markets are too small to do the same trick again. Mm. There's a whole conversation we could have sometime about whether the business model for investment banking's bust. I personally think it is, and it's not coming back. So saving the banks may be wrong for different reasons than people think. But nonetheless, as we go forward, what was the first response? Oh my God, we're falling off a cliff. Quick, where's that old copy of Keynes? Let's dust it off. We need to throw money at the economy because then people have confidence and spend. So we did 8 months of that. But 25 years of neoclassical thinking dies hard, particularly when it's institutionally embedded. And as soon as the crisis seemed to abate, suddenly, oh, there's going to be inflation. Well, there's no evidence of it. Looks like we're facing deflation. Oh, no, all that money, it's got to go somewhere. It'll end up inflation. Look, as you pointed out, we went from having a banking crisis to suddenly all of this sovereign debt. Look at these profligate governments. So the idea that we have now is the ideas that were around in the 1920s. Basically liquidate everything, slash costs, cut government budgets, get rid of debt simultaneously all at once, and the confidence fairy, as Paul Krugman puts it, or Joe Stiglitz puts it, will come along and everything will be fine. That's not going to work. It's just simply not going to work. So if we really seriously follow these austerity politics right across the developed world, the ideas will be, as they usually are, keep doing it, you haven't tried hard enough. And look, it's hurting. If it's hurting, it's working. And then when you get to that point and people are no longer willing to bear it and they start throwing the rascals out and so on and so forth, then the argument will be we never tried hard enough. Had we stayed the course, everything would have been fine. So as we go forward the next couple of years, they are going to be the arguments you hear. keep going. If it ain't hurting, it ain't working, and we have to stay the course. And we'll keep doing that until it's no longer bearable to do it. And then at that point, we'll try and figure out something else to do once we've wasted all that time, all that money, and all of those resources.
Austerity, as far as the eye can see.
Austerity, as far as my eyes can see, on a good day when it's not too dark without field glasses.
Last question, while we're still sober. What does a political economist learn from WikiLeaks?
Something really heartening. And it's funny because given what I just said about the whole idea of American empire or whatever, I'm sure some of your listeners will be jumping up and down going, that's complete bullshit. Of course, America's an empire. I think we found out from WikiLeaks that it really isn't. There's no secret messages being sent around through the embassies saying, embassy number five, you will assassinate the problem, right? What you seem to find out from WikiLeaks is that the State Department are as screwed up and clueless as everybody else. And I don't mean that in a naive way, in a sense of they're not pulling some set of giant Machiavellian strings from Washington. They're saying, what the hell's going on? We don't really know. We've got this information source and we're trying to figure this out. And here's what we think about this guy, but we're not really sure. And what came out of this whole thing was a picture of American foreign policy as a bunch of guys trying to figure out what's going on, being relatively successful at it, and simply not running around the world organizing coups. So what? If WikiLeaks was intended to show the awfulness of the empire, what it showed was the utter banality of diplomacy and how the United States is just like everybody else, trying to figure out what the hell's going on and trying really hard not to screw up any more than it already has.
Mark Blythe, you're priceless. It looks clear to me now.
Well, it's been clear for a long time, Chris.
Good luck in 2011. We'll have many good gabs about it.
I certainly hope so. And, you know, if the whole world ends before then, just remember, drink whiskey. It's good for you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.